Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcasts at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast, or it's simpler to use a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports and find advice for listening to shortwave at home. Please check out the website and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, NHK Japan, France 24, and Radio Havana Cuba. We will begin with Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. Excerpts from an interview with Stephen Wertheim, an analyst at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Iran and the United States rejected each other's ceasefire proposals. There's little evidence that the war is winding down soon. He discusses why the original agreement failed and if there is an off-ramp from the war that's being prepared. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
Iran has rejected a U.S. ceasefire proposal to end the war that the U.S. and Israel started against it. Instead, Tehran has issued its own counteroffer, which includes an end to the murder of its leaders, guarantees against future wars, reparations, and recognized control over the Strait of Hormuz. With the two sides still far apart, fighting is continuing on multiple fronts. Iran has launched fresh retaliatory missile and drone attacks against Israel and Gulf states. Meanwhile, the United States is reinforcing its military presence, deploying additional troops to the region amid fears that the conflict could widen even further.
While U.S. and Israeli airstrikes continue to pummel Iran, the Trump administration is also apparently trying to coax Tehran to the negotiating table. Pakistani officials who delivered the plan to Iran summed up Washington's goals: to rein in Iran's nuclear program, limit Iran's ballistic missile program, end Iran's support of regional militias, and reopen and stabilize shipping through the Strait of Hormuz. In return, the U.S. is offering to end sanctions and cooperate with Iran on civilian nuclear power. But so far, Tehran has shown little interest in negotiations.
We state this very clearly. Until it is our will, nothing will go back to the way it was. That will only come about when the very thought of acting against the Iranian nation is completely wiped from your corrupt minds.
So Iran is continuing to launch missiles and drones at Israel and various targets in the region. In Kuwait City, an Iranian drone blew up a fuel tank at the international airport. And in Tel Aviv, an Iranian strike managed to get through Israel's vaunted Iron Dome, damaging these apartments. The U.S. has also announced it's deploying at least 1,000 troops of its elite 82nd Airborne Division. They'll be supplementing the some 50,000 troops already in the region. Military experts say the airborne troops could be used to launch attacks on airfields or islands in the Persian Gulf.
Well, let's look at where we are now with a historian. Stephen Wertheim is a historian of U.S. foreign policy and an analyst at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Welcome to DW. So we have Iran rejecting these U.S. proposals and countering with its own maximalist offers. Now the U.S. reported to be sending thousands more troops to the region. This doesn't sound like a war that's about to wind down.
It does not. Good to be with you, Phil. I see extremely little evidence that a diplomatic deal is coming together. At best, we're at the beginning of the two sides making contact. The United States, as you mentioned, put out a maximalist proposal, essentially calling for the satisfaction of all of Washington's grievances with Iran over the years. No enrichment of uranium, no missiles, no support for regional proxies. Not going to happen. Now, today, Iran has responded in kind, demanding not only no restrictions on missiles, but also reparations for this war, the ability to go control who goes through the Strait of Hormuz going forward, also not going to happen. So it may be that next week, Iran and the United States sit down, perhaps in Pakistan, and open a dialogue. But as of now, if the proposals and counterproposals suggest anything, it's that this war is not likely to stop in the near future.
It's hard to see why Iran would trust any offer that the United States comes up with, or indeed agreed to, given that the U.S. was the prime mover behind the 2015 nuclear deal, which Donald Trump then tore up in his first term, and the fact that America and Israel started bombing their bombing campaign during actual negotiations with Iran. Why would Iran trust an interlocutor like that?
That is a real problem. The Iranians have good reason to suspect that attempts to negotiate by the Trump administration are a ruse, perhaps meant to buy time so that forces can flow into the region in preparation potentially for an action on the ground with U.S. troops. But Iran has been burned by diplomacy with the United States. The United States and Iran did a pragmatic nuclear deal in 2015 under the Obama administration that just managed to pass muster in the U.S. Congress, but Republicans were heavily opposed to it. Many Democrats had misgivings. The deal ultimately failed, not because Iran didn't comply, but because, in a sense, it complied. And what enough influential people in the United States feared was an Iran that would be normalized in its influence in the region without a nuclear weapon, in my view. And so Donald Trump tore up the nuclear deal, said he wanted a new one, but has in his second term made demands like zero uranium enrichment, which Iran does have a right to do at low levels suitable only for civilian use. That was a kind of poison pill. And now twice in the midst of negotiations, the United States and Israel have attacked Iran.
Is there an off-ramp for either side?
Well, in this conflict, I don't see many signs of an off-ramp right now. Iran, its priority is to reestablish deterrence, to make sure that if this current war ends, there won't be another attack in a few months or a few years. So I think Tehran is aiming to put strain on the American economy in particular to try to prevent that. Trump, for his part, has a poor record of concluding actual deals, never mind his rhetoric about always wanting to make a deal. So I think in this particular conflict, the best chance for an off-ramp is if Trump just decides enough is enough. He's won. He's going to claim victory. He wants to stop. He tells Israel to stop. That leaves Iran. Iran will likely continue to try to obstruct shipping through the Strait of Hormuz. But over time, its ability to do that is likely to diminish as more and more countries around the world tell it that this is a big problem and Iran should cut it out at this point. So I think the best off-ramp right now is actually a halt to the fighting by one side, hopefully followed by the other, as opposed to a diplomatic agreement. But that really just begs the question that you asked also, what comes after that? Right. There really does need to be a diplomatic solution to this problem.
Stephen Wertheim from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
That excerpted analysis was from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com, as well as on YouTube at their channels called DW News and DW Documentary. The entire interview, entitled U.S.-Iran Ceasefire, What's in Iran's Counterproposal, is available online and highly recommended. DW is also available at most podcast sites, as is the Shortwave Report. Next, NHK Japan. Australia and the European Union have concluded talks on a free trade agreement, which will remove almost all tariffs between them. Ukraine announced attacks on key Russian oil facilities, including one 1,400 kilometers from the border. Russia retaliated by attacking the Ukrainian defense industry. The foreign ministers of China and Iran spoke by phone on Tuesday, with China recommending negotiations. NHK Japan.
Australia and the European Union say they have concluded negotiations on a free trade agreement. Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese and European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen held a news conference in Canberra on Tuesday. They announced the conclusion of the talks that were launched in 2018.
The Australia-European Free Trade Agreement will lower trade and investment barriers between Australia and the EU, a market of around 450 million people. This agreement is worth $10 billion to the Australian economy on an annual basis.
Today, we are telling an important story to a world that is deeply changing. A world where great powers are using tariffs as a leverage and supply chains as vulnerabilities to be exploited. In our story, open, rules-based trade delivers positive-sum outcomes.
The joint statement welcomes the conclusion. The European Commission says under the free trade deal, Australia has agreed to remove over 99% of tariffs on EU goods. It also says Australia will gradually remove duties on EU dairy and instantly on wine and chocolate. On the other hand, Australia says the EU will abolish all tariffs on energy and resource exports, including critical minerals.
Ukraine's military announced that it conducted attacks on key Russian oil facilities. It has long accused Moscow of using oil sales to fund the conflict. The General Staff of the Armed Forces says it struck the oil port of Primorsk on the Baltic Sea. Reuters news agency reports the terminal had suspended oil exports after Sunday's attacks. The Ukrainian military also says it hit a central Russian oil refinery about 1,400 kilometers from the border. Kyiv has criticized the U.S. for easing sanctions on Russian oil. Washington took the step to bring down surging oil prices caused by the conflict in Iran. Moscow retaliated for the attacks. The Russian Defense Ministry says its forces carried out strikes targeting Ukraine's defense industry.
China says Foreign Minister Wang Yi spoke by phone with Iranian counterpart Abbas Araghchi on Tuesday. Wang told him that any problem should be solved through dialogue and negotiations, not by the use of force. He also expressed hope that relevant countries will start peace negotiations. Araghchi said that Iranians will unite further, resist acts of external aggression, and defend the nation's sovereignty and independence. He added Iran is working hard toward not only a temporary, but a full ceasefire.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan on shortwave. They're heard at 10 p.m. at 11735 or on the web at www.3.nhk.or.jp. NHK may also be found easily at most podcast sites. All the times I announce are for Pacific Daylight Saving Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. On to France 24. It appears that some investors used insider trading information to buy $500 million of oil stocks short on Monday, just 15 minutes before Trump posted that the war was winding down, which caused the price to drop 14%. The cost of oil has led many countries to further invest in renewables, but the United States returned nearly $1 billion to French company Total Energies to drop its plans to build wind farms off the U.S. eastern coast. France 24.
Speculation has been swirling that some investors may have used inside information to actually make a killing on oil markets last week.
So Monday we saw Donald Trump step back, at least temporarily, from his threat to escalate the war by attacking Iranian civilian power plants. That announcement quickly sent crude prices sharply downward. Just 15 minutes before the president's statement, a massive volume of oil contracts changed hands, and those who had bet on falling prices made a big profit. A similarly huge burst of trading in S&P 500 futures has led to widespread suspicion of insider trading. Delano D'Souza has the details.
It's an anomaly which stood out on global trading floors at the start of the week.
C'est quelqu'un qui a vendu à...
Someone sold oil at an excellent price a few minutes before the price dropped over 10%. So it's a great trade.
Donc c'est une très belle opération financière.
A transaction placed Monday when the energy markets were stable, 15 minutes before a Truth Social post from Donald Trump. It resulted in the price of oil plunging 14%. A windfall for whoever hedged their bets.
It raises some questions. Either someone has a great instinct and a lot of luck, which can happen, or it was someone who was tipped off. There aren't other possibilities.
Traders reportedly made bets worth around $500 million in the oil market before Trump's post. And for now, it's unclear if one or several entities were behind Monday's trades. While the White House says the administration doesn't tolerate any official illegally profiteering off of insider trading, some Democrats are raising alarm bells, calling the moves mind-blowing corruption. For now, there isn't any proof of market manipulation, but Monday's well-timed trades are similar to profitable bets made on prediction site Polymarket, which allows clients to place wagers on real-world events. Certain users anticipated the capture of Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro or the killing of Iran's supreme leader, with some accounts created a few minutes before the incident unfolded.
Brian, the ongoing oil crisis is reinforcing many countries' resolve to continue the transition to renewable energies, but not all of them.
So China may be the world's top oil importer, but it has also made huge strides towards electrifying its energy grid, adding massive amounts of solar and wind energy in recent years. The U.S., under the Trump administration, though, is actually paying energy companies like Total to abandon green power projects and return to fossil fuels. Simon Moritz takes a closer look.
For some at the China Development Forum this week, the war in the Middle East has prompted calls for greater investment in renewable energies. Though Iran has signaled its willingness to let non-hostile ships through the Strait of Hormuz, the choke point through which one-fifth of the world's oil and liquefied gas passes, the shocks to crude supplies and markets since the start of the war have prompted a crisis not seen since the 1970s.
The current international landscape highlights that fossil fuels, such as oil and gas, often rely on imports and international transportation, whereas renewable energy sources like wind and solar are locally available and do not require such processes.
According to the International Renewable Energy Agency, more than 90% of green power projects were cheaper in 2024 than fossil fuel alternatives. Asia, where most of that oil was headed, is the hardest hit. But some countries are more prepared than others. China, the biggest importer of oil worldwide, has expanded renewables on a massive scale, thus making the country's economy less vulnerable to the price shocks.
It was billed as a landmark agreement, but for environmentalists, it's a massive regression. At CERAWeek in Houston, French energy giant TotalEnergies officially pulled the plug on nearly $1 billion worth of offshore wind projects in the U.S., as their investment for renewable energy was reimbursed. The strategic retreat is fueled by a desire for immediate, high-yield returns from natural gas, a move that prioritizes the portfolios of fossil fuel shareholders and the political standing of an oil-friendly administration over the long-term survival of the climate.
The idea is to release these two concessions back to the government. We'll get a dollar per dollar. We invested exactly $928 million in this lease. And we will reinvest them this year in 26 to accelerate some projects, in particular in LNG.
While Guyane frames the move as a win-win for energy reliability, those protesting outside CERAWeek see a much darker reality. For local activists, this isn't a strategic shift. It's a betrayal of the planet by executives they say are captured by oil interests.
Patrick Pouyanné's decision to go back on offshore wind and reinvest the money in oil and gas shows that Patrick Pouyanné never wanted Total Énergie to be an energy company, that Total is still an oil and gas company.
As the conference continues under the cloud of an international energy crisis, the message from the streets is clear. The transition is being traded for short-term profit.
Those reports were from France 24, which may be easily found at their website, france24.com, as well as a YouTube channel called France 24 English, also most podcast sites. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or could help support this show, like listeners in Toronto, Ontario, New York City, and Ashland, Oregon did this week, my PayPal contact information is available at my website, outfarpress.com, or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. I am truly grateful for the donations. They are essential for the weekly production and website fees for this show, which I supply freely to more than 100 radio stations around the world. And if you're listening on a public radio station, please support them as well. We will conclude with Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba has been on the air this week. Mexican President Sheinbaum gave her support to the flotillas bringing aid to Cuba, including using a ship to protect them at sea. And she says she is working to find a way to get fuel to the country. Code Pink with 140 people was successful in bringing aid to Havana, and on Tuesday a Mexican tuna boat delivered 30 tons of humanitarian aid. The U.S. has been working to impede the renowned International Cuban Medical Brigades from doing their life-saving work in Latin America. Radio Havana, Cuba.
Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum confirmed that on Monday, the 23rd of March, a new ship has departed from Mexican territory headed for Cuba. During her daily press conference, the Mexican president said that her administration would maintain its support on a consistent basis, highlighted the mediation efforts that Mexico is undertaking to foster dialogue between Havana and Washington. Sheinbaum clarified that her stance is grounded in respect for the self-determination of nations and the conviction that any dispute must be resolved through multilateral mechanisms. Within the framework of the United Nations, an international body she called upon to become involved in the delivery of solidarity aid to the island. Separately, the official reported that the Mexican Navy is providing an escort support to international brigades transporting aid collected for the island aboard smaller vessels. This security measure aims to ensure the safety of the crews during the voyage, as well as the small size of the ships posing a navigational risk. Subsequently, on Saturday, the 21st of March, the final two sailboats of the Mexican delegation belonging to the Nuestra America convoy set sail and are now bound for Cuba. In addition to the provisions and assistance materials that Mexico continues to send to Cuba, she said that her administration is seeking alternatives to resume fuel shipments to the island. We're also exploring ways, she said, to deliver fuel without negatively affecting Mexico, whether it's humanitarian aid or even through commercial agreements. The delegation from the U.S. anti-war action organization Code Pink, a member of the International Nuestra America convoy, concluded its stay on the island on Monday. They returned to the United States with the firm conviction that they must intensify their opposition to the U.S. blockade against the Caribbean nation. The more than 140 activists who made up the commission confirmed that the distribution of resources aimed to alleviate the shortages of basic goods currently facing Cuba. Code Pink emphasized the United States attempts to isolate Cubans and separate them from the rest of the world. But all over the world, we say Cuba is not alone. Trump's offensive, rejected by various leaders and organizations around the world, including the United Nations, resulted in fuel shortages throughout Cuba. In response, citizens from a number of countries have maintained an active mobilization in support of the Cuban people. The Nuestra America convoy stands as a prime example of this effort. Yesterday, Tuesday, the tuna fishing vessel Maguro arrived in Havana carrying more than 30 tons of humanitarian aid on board for the people of the Caribbean island amid a crisis exacerbated by economic restrictions imposed by the United States. The cargo also included 73 solar panels destined for health centers, in addition to staple foods such as rice, beans, and cereals, along with medicines and hygiene products, all donations originating from various nations. On board were 32 people from 11 countries who have joined forces to support the people of Cuba amidst the difficult situation that they are currently facing. Cuban Foreign Minister Bruno Rodriguez denounced that the United States government is exerting intense pressure and employing blackmail tactics against countries in Latin America and the Caribbean to ensure that Cuban medical brigades leave every country in the region where they are currently serving. The head of the Caribbean nation's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Bruno Rodriguez, noted that Washington not only seeks to strike a blow against the humanist and solidarity-based program created by Cuba and Fidel Castro, but also to continue cutting off sources of revenue for our economy. Bruno Rodriguez warned that those primarily affected by these maneuvers are the most vulnerable sectors of the region, which for decades have received assistance from Cuban professionals to access basic health care services. The International Caribbean Assistance Program by Cuba began in 1963 with its first deployment of Cuban doctors and nurses to Algeria in 1963, driven by the vision of Fidel Castro. At that time, facing the departure of French doctors following the independence of Algeria, the Cuban leader called upon volunteers to assist a nation suffering from health care shortages. Since that mission back in 1963, more than 600,000 Cuban professionals have provided services in 165 nations. The creation of the Comprehensive Health Program in 1998, following the passage of Hurricanes Mitch and George through Central America, with the formation of the Henry Reeve contingent, the Operation Miracle, all underscore a track record of service in rural areas, low-income communities, and regions affected by natural disasters and epidemics. However, smear campaigns promoted by Washington have led to the termination of agreements in Central America and the Caribbean. In Honduras, for example, following the decision by Nasri Asfura's government to end the collaboration, Cuba's Ministry of Public Health reported that the interruption of work that since 2024 had amounted to more than 30 million medical consultations and nearly 900,000 surgical interventions within Honduras.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website is working well at radiohc.cu, but there's no podcasts. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140 and from 6 p.m. to midnight at 6,000. At their website, radiohc.cu, you can stream the English version at noon, Monday through Friday, Pacific Daylight Time. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. You do have to work harder these days because of U.S. and EU prohibitions on media. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for the show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find information for online support. Please consider subscribing. There's a link at my website along with a podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 29th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. On the next show, the Shortwave Report will be celebrating having been on the air for 30 years without a break. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.